A good number of years ago, a few of us went on a trip, an excursion. We gathered together somewhere here in the Bay Area, and we drove up to Abhayagiri Monastery. It's a Theravadan Buddhist monastery in Ukiah. And it was kind of a nice drive to go up there, and they're about 3-4 hours away, so it's a bit of a journey. And as the way good journeys are, you know, you kind of took time to, you know, leave behind the more busy life of the Bay Area and heading kind of into Northern California, more rural parts of California. And in that drive, you know, I was going to a monastery and so with Dharma friends. And it was, you know, nice to kind of settle in. And then at some point you go through Ukiah and you come into a valley where this monastery is. It's called Redwood Valley. And it's a beautiful rural little valley that you go in. And it was a nice, you know, in terms of a transition from the urban area and the busyness of life. And you come into this quiet, peaceful valley, drive up this road. And then at some point you drive up this dry, steep little driveway up into a flat part of the hillside where there's a parking space and walk, and you walk a little bit further up, and you come to another flat area, which is where they have a kind of a meditation hall, and they have the old house that was on the property that is where they have their dining room. And it's a California chaparral oak vegetation. It was relatively warm, and it's a particular kind of peacefulness and calm in a California oak kind of chaparral kind of location. And so we stepped into this warm, dry, peaceful, still place, and that was nice to be there. There had been people practicing there for some years, the monks and other people, lay people who came there to practice, and we spent time with the abbots. Back then they had two abbots, and we had that delightful time with them, and they're people who inspire me greatly and very mature in their practice. And it was nice to be inspired by their presence, their practice. And they had a certain kind of stillness. They had a certain kind of freedom from usual issues around identity or desires. And they were happy to see us, but I didn't feel like they wanted anything from us. They were responsive in a nice way, and you felt their goodness, and it was just kind of nice to be around someone like them, and it was nice, enjoyed it. And so then it was time, so as customary, many of us brought along with us food to donate to the monastery, because the monastics will often live on just the food that's donated to them at any given time. And at that time, there weren't a lot of visitors to the monastery, especially during the week. We came during the week. So I think all of us brought offerings for the monastics, and I knew that some times of the year that there aren't a lot of visitors, and back then they didn't have sometimes that much food. So I brought, I think, a few big bags of canned beans, or I don't know what it was, you know, kind of dry goods and stuff that would last for a while, so we could feed them for a while, you know. So we all brought to the kitchen. We offered it to there, and it was nice. And then I think some of us, I think, were involved helping making the meal for that day. Just they already had a menu planned, and so we were just maybe, I don't know what we were doing. And then it was time to eat. And the way it worked, the monks were lined up against a wall. There was maybe, at that point, maybe somewhere between maybe six who were there. I don't remember how, weren't that many. And the lay people like us were sitting in kind of the other side of the room, and we were also going to eat, but first the monastics are served. And so it was a beautiful little setting. They were sitting there in certain dignity and stillness, and again I could feel they were just seemingly, at least the appearance of just, they were just there in a peaceful way, and kind of like they weren't like looking at the kitchen, smacking their lips, and, you know, wow, you know, you can't wait to eat, and, you know, they were just there, and they were almost like in a kind of quiet, contemplative way, and seemed like they were content. And certainly the two abbots that I know, and they just you know, just their subtleness and their peacefulness and just how they are, in a kind of humble maybe, or just in no pretentious way, and not trying to be anybody. And it was nice to be around that for me. And so then the food was carried out to offer it to the monks. And how it works is that lay people carry the food out, and the monks would serve themselves from the serving bowl into their eating bowl, and go down the row, and they'd all feed themselves. And when they were all finished being served, then there'd be some chanting. But as the food came in, someone would announce who had made the offering of that food. And all my friends had brought prepared food, but I had brought dry goods that could be cooked later. And it dawned on me very quickly that all my friends, their names were going to be recited, announced. And all the names would be announced but one. And that was me. So here I was in this very peaceful setting and quiet place, and inspired by the people who were not caught up in trying to prove who they were or prove they were special in some way or wanting anything from me. And there's welled up inside of me this feeling of, oh, but, you know, I have to tell you that I brought food too. I brought it, but, you know, it just wasn't cooked today. But, you know, I've been around this Buddhist scene for long enough to know that that was also problematic, to kind of assert myself, look at me, and you know, I'm special too, and, you know, I get to count too, and, you know. So I was kind of stuck between, you know, the rock and a hard place, right? I mean, I was going to lose no matter what. I was going to be crushed myself in any of my issues of being someone special or being someone who's not, you know, I was going to be seen forever as not being generous or, you know, who knows what I was, you know, so I could feel this. And there it was, this contrast between this peaceful place. And, you know, the monastery had this kind of, not a huge place, it's on a hillside, but it has a feeling of spaciousness, of stillness for me, and kind of a peaceful place. And the atmosphere was quite strong. In the middle of the atmosphere, there was this agitation. This kind of, like, I felt this compulsion. I had to speak, I had to say something. I had to hold myself back, you know, it's like the rodeo. And try to stay on my seat and not say anything. And so there was all this kind of, you know, agitation inside, and then there was all this peace around. So one of the things that happened was I kind of lost touch with the peace in the place. It kind of became like the agitation and my concern and my feeling to say something and my embarrassment and all these things that I was operating filled my universe. Like that's kind of just spread out, kind of like, or spread out or filled it, or I don't know if it filled it, but at least there was no room for any other universe, other parts of the universe in that concern. I was like kind of locked in or kind of in this little kind of claustrophobic space, where a kind of space that I'm familiar with, where it kind of feels like this is, you know, this is it. This is like everything is within this space of this kind of preoccupation and thoughts and concerns. So, but I was in this nice, peaceful environment. So where did that agitation live? Where did it exist? It was not in the monastics there. It was not in my friends who were there. It was not in the room. It was not in the food that was being served. I couldn't look out the windows to look for it. The agitation that I had was all here in me. That's where it lived. And there was a world of difference between seeing, oh, it's this little thing, you know, I'm relatively, you know, small piece of the universe. And, you know, in this terms of the scale of the universe, I'm like pretty teeny. And, you know, and here was a little teeny little kind of thing, agitation doing its thing. And there's a very different to feel that agitation, to feel that tightening, that compulsion, as just those thing in and of itself, in a wider space of stillness or peace or something, versus only living in that agitation, living in that contraction, and having a sense that this is the universe. Not that we think this way, not that we engage that way, you know, actively, but it's kind of, I think, as an, it's kind of like it can be so strong, our thoughts, our beliefs, our projections, our judgments, our emotions, and we kind of live in them. And because we live in them, they kind of, there's almost as if there's no outside. It's kind of like they, I mean, there's no space, there's no shape around these things, but it's kind of how we see, what you see through them, or we relate to the world through them. And so it's as if everything is, you know, I wouldn't say everything is that agitated, but it's kind of like, you know, it's kind of just, and if someone has spent a lifetime in this kind of inner world landscape where they always see through their agitation or see through their compulsions or see through their fear, it's kind of like those things, the fear and the compulsions and the thoughts, the thinking, and the world out there are kind of entangled, are not so separate. And so it's very easy to have projections, all kinds of ideas, all kinds of judgments and biases that spill out, and it's kind of, without any self-awareness of how it operates, it can seem like we're seeing accurately and truly the world. And we're seeing ourselves accurately and truly. This is how it is. But I could see it. I was in this quiet, peaceful place and setting, and I, you know, I had done some practice by then. So, you know, I knew a little bit about how to bring attention and mindfulness to myself and not to kind of... And I could see of just that I had a certain attachment to my certain idea of how I wanted to be seen or how I wanted not to be seen. I had a concern about these things. And I could see that there was a kind of compulsion or contraction around this concern. And so I could relax around it. And as I relaxed into it, relaxed around it, then I kind of returned in harmony with the peacefulness of the place. But then they'd announce the next person. And then I'd have to go through this little, you know, mindfulness and pay attention, to feel the contraction, feel the strong desire to say something, to do something, and then come back into harmony, in a sense, with the place. Some of you at the opening circle mentioned about, one person said, stepping in through the front door, immediately there was a release of certain stress that they were carrying them, just being here. It's not an uncommon experience for some people to come here and feel palpable, some visceral kind of shift. There's a stillness here, a peacefulness here, and some people come into the meditation hall for the first time, and especially if there's no one here, it's a little bit feels like a little force field of peace or stillness or something. It's a quite nice the first time, and then we get busy with the retreat and we're into our little world, and then we do come in and we don't notice anymore, maybe. And so the theme of this retreat is the Four Noble Truths, and one of the really key teachings of the Buddha. It's been said by the Buddha's disciple, Sariputta, that all of the Dharma could be somehow be subsumed or held inside of the teachings of the Four Noble Truths. Just like the footprint of an elephant in the jungle is so big that it'll all the other footprints of all the other animals can fit inside. So everything fits inside the Four Noble Truths. That gives them a very great importance in the tradition. It's considered to be, for many people, to be the central teachings of the Buddha. And it's a brilliant teaching. It's a wonderful thing, and it's been a very important part of my life to explore it, get to know it, and myself in it. But I want to offer you an entryway into it, this topic, by sharing with you a very simple question that I ask myself regularly. And the question is, am I suffering? And if I'm not, then I'm content and I proceed as I'm doing. I just continue with what's going on, whatever needs to happen. But if I am suffering, then I get interested. If I am suffering, if I'm somehow feel stress, feel unease, feel tense, feel disturbed, feel agitated, feel contracted. The word I've been liking a lot lately is coagulated. There's all these different, the word suffering is such a big word, but it's supposed to include like this whole range of the most subtle kind of things to the biggest possible existential sufferings we can have. And so if I am suffering, then I stop for it, it's not the right time and place. But not just stop for it, but to welcome it. But not to welcome it to suffer better. Those Buddhists, they really know how to suffer. They've been working at it for a long time. But rather, it just feels so much better to welcome it as a subject of study. Welcome it to get to know it, as opposed to, oh no, resist it, this is terrible, it shouldn't be here, run away, close down. One of my favorite dysfunctional ways of dealing with stress and suffering is the ostrich approach of sticking my head in the sand, as if everything will go away, everything's okay if you don't see it. So I've had a history of kind of pulling back and not paying attention. And probably you have your favorite way of, dysfunctional way of meeting. Some people it's avoidance, some people it's blame and anger, some people it's distraction, some people it's self-blame, some people it's to be a victim and feel sorry for oneself and expect other people to do it. Some people, it's to look around for a savior and someone who can fix it. Some people, it's to analyze everything to great detail, down to the, spend a long time, reviewing and thinking and analyzing. And so all kinds of ways that people, that I'm characterizing here as something different than welcoming it. Welcoming it as a field of study. Welcoming it, saying, okay, we're together right now, and I'm going to get to know you. But it's a lot easier to welcome it and get to know it if there's some, if we're a little bit settled, if we're a little bit stable. The Buddha, when he taught about the Four Noble Truths, he encouraged people to develop concentration. Or a synonym I have for samadhi is stability. If a person has samadhi or stability of mind, then we can see things as they really are. And so to be settled enough to be able to see what's happening clearly enough so we're not living in it and seeing through it. So we could, there's all kinds of very difficult suffering people experience, but if what they know from a whole lifetime of how to live their lives is to see the world through their thoughts, through their feelings, through it all that, as if they are those things, that's one way of being. But if you step back and welcome it, then in a certain kind of way, you're a little bit separate from your suffering. Your little bit, maybe I like to think of you're bigger than it. Your little bit, you can meet it with some modicum of strength or independence or freedom. You're not identified fully with it or lost in it. So just, okay, here, I'm suffering here. Okay, welcome. It's a powerful thing to do, to say welcome. It doesn't mean that you condone it. It doesn't mean that you approve of it. It doesn't mean that you have to just now accept it and just, you know, be miserable. It means that now we're going to, in the best way that I can, the most mature way that I can, I'm going to really be present for this and see it, understand it. And one of the tasks that Oren talked about for the First Noble Truth is to understand it. And the wording of the First Noble Truth is that this is the noble truth of suffering, of dukkha. And the word this is really important. Some people will say, what's the First Noble Truth? Oh, the noble truth of suffering. But there's this is the noble truth of suffering. It's meant to be always particular. It's not really meant to be a general philosophical statement about reality or life, or, you know, you can people do that with it, but the Pali word idam, this. And so, oh, here's my suffering. This is suffering. And so, oh, this is what's happening. Oh, I'm just suffering. There are times I've been kind of lost in my machinations of my mind and, you know, not confused and kind of reacting. And then I've kind of, oh, this is suffering. And as soon as I say that, something in me settles in that recognition. And sometimes it takes a while to get to that place where I kind of stop and, oh, this is what's happening. And then, so this the particularity of it. So when you hear teachings about the Four Noble Truths, you need to be I would suggest you be a little bit careful not to universalize them or make them into a grand philosophical kind of doctrine that's supposed to apply everywhere in all possible ways. There might be some truth to that, but I think for the Buddha, it's always meant to be practical. It's always meant to be immediate and here, and what's really going on for you now? You're the only one who can figure that out. Only you can really meet who you are now. So to welcome suffering is also a way of meeting oneself. It's a way of beginning to look at where the genesis, where the activity of suffering is, when all the way around you, there's space. There's a vast universe that has stillness, has a certain degree of peacefulness. I mean, you know, in this room here, middle of a meditation session, it's a little bit peaceful here and still and calm. A certain kind of calm and stillness sometimes that's different than almost any other time you have 45 people together in a room this size. It's kind of precious. And then there's me with my agitation, and, you know, all the stuff going on. And to see it as, although it's just here, it's this very localized event. At IRC, the weather is very localized. Just how this is what's happening now. Not to belittle it, not to dismiss it or disrespect it, but to kind of give it a more realistic context. That it's just something that's happening here, now. It's this. It's not the everything. It's not the universe. It's not the future. Everything is here. It's not the past. It's just this moment, to meet it here. It might have a past, it might have a future, but to just meet it here. What is that like? It's a lot of what, you know, the mindfulness practice is about, is learning how to meet this moment here. Learning how to welcome it. Learn how to be present for it. in a way that is wise, a way that is has freedom as part of it. We're not entangled with it. To be with present for it in a clear way, in a settled way, in a matter-of-fact way, and in a way that clearly recognizes, oh, this is what it is. So if there's suffering, we stop for it and notice it and be present for it. And then the question is, what's wise? What's a wise thing to do? On the first day of the retreat, first, second day of the retreat, I know there's a lot of suffering here. There all kinds of issues can come up. We bring along our life, sometimes what's happened recently in our life, sometimes what happened early in our life, and happened all along in our life. There's a tremendous amount of challenges people live under. And it's not easy to live this human life. And so this not easy, all the aspects of it show up here. And this is meant to be a place that's appropriate to have it come, and so we can meet it and be with it and see it. And so we see it, and so what's the wise way of being with it? And it might be that the wise way, the first couple of days, is not to do too much about it. Just go back to your breathing. Because the alternative is to go back into a world of reacting and thinking and solving and the usual way of to being in the mind. And as the Buddha said, it's good to get settled first before we really look at suffering. And it might work for some of you to just, you know, just recognize and acknowledge, yeah, there's some difficulty I have here, and thoughts that are difficult, and memories or feelings that are difficult. And I recognize it, I welcome it in a certain kind of way, but this is not the time to really engage, and I'll just come back to my breathing. Come back to the breathing and breathe, and hopefully something will settle over the days of, you know, and then at some point maybe it's possible to look more deeply. And we start seeing that suffering is not a single thing. It's a composite. It's made up of many factors that come together. It's a little ecology of things that are going on. And then the most common way that the Four Noble Truths are taught is the second noble truth is a truth of the cause of suffering. And here again, this word idam is used. This is the cause of suffering. And then they specify what the cause is. And the cause is the simple, simplest kind of way it's taught is the craving. The word is tanna, which literally means thirst. And it's the idea that suffering, the cause of suffering is craving. Some people protest, some people are confused by this because it seems a little bit, doesn't seem logical. So there's a couple of things about this. I'll go into this more about how other people can be the cause of our suffering, and people do tremendously terrible things to each other. So to say I'm the cause when this person's, you know, hitting me over the head with a hammer, you know, that doesn't seems kind of crazy to say it that, you know, okay, like this person's hitting me over the head, but I know I'm the cause of my suffering, so I'm going to sit here and welcome it and go into my mind and figure out what's going on. That doesn't make any sense. So one of the ways of understanding the relationship between the first and the second noble truth is to reverse the order and say it this way. If you crave, you will suffer. There's something about the nature of craving, a contraction, a compulsion, a drivenness. Craving is a kind of driven kind of thought and desire which we can't put down easily, where the tension or tightness or narrowing down that happens when that's present, we can't stop it. We say, okay, enough of that, I'll just kind of go about my life. But it's kind of, it's in there, and it's, you know. So if that kind of desire, so it's not just any old desire, because you can have desire that's, some people like me, I have, you know, desires are a dime a dozen for me. They just like they just come roll right through. It's so easy for me to have it. Some people have, you know, aversion is a dime a dozen. Just like, you know, that's what's easy to come through. But you know, I got this. I have this desire thing going, and so I just let them go through, and I don't usually pick them up. And some people are more the aversive types. In the Dharma, it's considered, in terms of Dharma practice, it's considered to be better to be an aversive type than a desire type. So in case you're the aversive type, no, don't feel bad. It's actually, there's some benefits to it in Dharma practice. But you know, so desire can happen, and there's good desires to have. There's appropriate desires to have, and we want you to have some desires here. If you need to pee, we want you to desire to go to the, we would like your desires to be, go to the toilet, please. You know, you don't sit here and say, I'm going to have no desires whatsoever, and just sit here and see what happens. some desires are not problematic, but it's a kind of desires that are characterized by this thirst or this craving. And if that kind of desire is there, there's suffering. And then if you let go of that craving, then that suffering will go away. So we have to, I think we have to be a little bit nuanced or careful how we interpret these Four Noble Truths to understand it in ways that are more easy to understand as being practical and useful. So if someone's hitting you over the head, tell them to stop. Lift up your hand and block their blow. Go away. Get help. Don't spend time, you know, looking deep in your head and what's going on. But there's plenty of suffering where there's no imminent and immediate danger. And then it might be interesting to look and see, is there craving in here? And there might be, there might not be. Some things that we call suffering in popular contemporary English might not be the kind of suffering the Buddha was talking about. So I think sometimes if there's a loss, someone has died, that we feel sad, I kind of think it's just a completely ordinary form of discomfort. It's appropriate. Some people might call it suffering, but that, there's no craving, or it might not be any craving or attachment connected to it, and so it's appropriate to welcome it. Some feelings of grief are completely healthy and appropriate. Some feelings of sadness. There's doesn't need to be seen as being a problem. It's part of being a human being. But is there craving? If there is not, maybe just let nature take its course. Let it unfold, let it heal, let it do what it needs to do. But if there's craving, then the second noble truth, if we recognize that's what's going on, and we can see that that's the cause, then we can do the next noble truth, third noble truth, which is to let go. To look for the place where it ceases, it comes to an end. And there, I think it's something we all do. These four noble truths are not esoteric or mystical. Or I think that someone who's never heard about the four noble truths, you know, we'll do it. If, you know, it's as simple as if you go to the, if you're at a, if you're impatient where you're driving, and you really, really want to get someplace, and the light turns red, and you have to stop and wait, and the light is really, you know this red light is a really long light. And then not only that, but there's five cars in front of you, and some of them are not going when it turns green. And so, you know, two of them made it across, but you have to wait even more a long time. And so the impatience, the desire to get some there, you know, is a tightening, and you feel so your foot is on the gas pedal, kind of like ready to rev up, and even maybe even revving your car, ready to go, because you're in a hurry, as if you can go faster than the car that's in front of you. And the tension builds, and you're holding the steering wheel tight. And if you blame the red light, you write letters to the traffic department, that's really missing the point if you want to find your freedom. And so an ordinary person might feel the impatience, feel the suffering of it, realize that there's nothing I can do, the light's red, and relax. Settle back for that period of time, for the minute. They've never heard about the Four Noble Truths. But it's kind of like as ordinary as, you know, you step on a thorn and you stop and pull it out. The thorn is the causing the suffering, the pain, so you pull it out. So it's an ordinary thing to do. What we with the Four Noble Truths, the idea is to really use this as a penetrating tool to really stop and look deep into our minds, to really start becoming a connoisseur or recognize carefully, what are we contributing? What's our contribution to the suffering in our terms of our clinging, our attachments? And then for some people, it becomes a debate. Some people want to defend their attachments, their clinging. They feel they're important. They feel, how can I live? How can I be taken care of? How can I be safe? How can I fight for justice unless I have that attachment? And so sometimes there's a debate goes on about this, whether it's, you know, should I or shouldn't I let go? And that's part of the grappling with this life of ours. I would just want to say, if you come up to that debate, and you stay in the debate, but really do well, give justice to both sides of it. Don't prioritize one side over the other. You know, try to be unbiased, you know, on both sides, and just kind of work it out, find your way. So then there's the second noble truth, is this is the cessation of suffering that comes with the cessation of this craving. And then the fourth noble truth is the noble truth of the Eightfold Path. And the Eightfold Path is not the cause for the cessation of letting, not the cause for letting go of craving, but it's setting up the conditions that makes it easier for us to see deeply into the nature of the mind and see into the nature of our attachments. And not only to see it, but see it in such a way that we hold it, or we are with it in a productive, useful way. We have enough stability, we have enough clarity, we have enough maybe kindness and compassion, we have enough ability to understand the dynamics of what's happening, so that at that point it becomes easier to let go. I can't tell you how many times I've heard, and maybe unfortunately sometimes I've said, or something like, oh, just let go, as if it's easy. Maybe at the traffic light it's easy, but with some of the huge issues that people struggle with in their lives, it's not so easy. And so the whole Eightfold Path is a way of, if people who really feel the value of these Four Noble Truths, value this approach of stopping and welcoming suffering, studying it, looking for the cause, that this is how to, you know, to prepare yourself for, or set up the stage to do it really well. So the Eightfold Path. So this is the most common teachings on the Four Noble Truths that I hear, that I know about here in the modern world, the teaching that there's a cause to suffering. It turns out that the Buddha said that when he taught the Four Noble Truths, that there were many explanations for them, many characteristics of them, and many ways in which they appear as we go through our lives. And in fact, the Buddha gave at least three distinct teachings of what's called the Four Noble Truths. And what comes down to us in the modern world, there's only one of them that we interpret to be the cause. And I found this very, very useful way of understanding. But so one of the other ways is to not see the second noble truth as the cause of suffering, but see it as a condition for suffering. And that kind of opens up the field to be a broader study, to look at not the cause, but rather it's one of the contributing conditions, craving. There are many conditions, and we're not really looking for cause, because cause is a little bit easy, if you look for cause, to feel like I'm responsible, it's me, that I'm the doer. And it's too easy to kind of look a little bit too narrow in our view. So when the Buddha taught about the conditionality around the Four Noble Truths, one of the teachings of the Four Noble Truths had to do with really clearly seeing the various conditions that come into play with the Four Noble Truths. Then it kind of encompasses a wider sphere. And when you see a wider sphere or aspect of what goes on in the mind, we actually have more opportunities to let go. We can find other ways to let go than simply letting go of craving. And so, for example, it might be that one of the classic examples would be that one of the conditions for the appearance of craving is that things are either pleasant or unpleasant. And so if we can notice that the condition for craving is pleasantness or unpleasantness, then it's possible to see that pleasant and unpleasant so clearly that we kind of let go before the craving arises. And it occasionally it becomes much simpler that way. We don't have to have any debates. We don't have to kind of, you know, look for where the button is to let go, to push the button so we can let go. We're meeting our life much more, the whole process earlier. And so sometimes it's more interesting to look, what's the condition for my suffering? And I think there's a shift of attention, shift of way of being. We say, oh, that craving is a condition for my suffering. It's not necessarily the cause. And just look for cause is too complicated. Then people, the cause and effect relationships, and there's other causes and other things. But craving is a centrally important condition. And maybe then it's easier to say, okay, that's a condition maybe I can now work with. I can relax around it. I don't have to question whether it is or not the cause, or who's the cause, or all that. It's just a condition, a contributing condition. Another way that the Four Noble Truths are taught is it's taught that craving, the second noble truth, is suffering. It's not the condition for it or the cause for it, which it can be. It's just simply craving is contraction. It has tension in it. It has discomfort in it. It has certain kind of pain in it. And that's fascinating to start seeing that. And then you don't have to, then it's kind of like, well, why would you ever want to crave? Why would I want to be attached when the very attachment itself is irritating me or harming me? And then it doesn't become so much debate about whether should I, shouldn't I cling to that thing, but rather something a little bit more earlier. It's like, why should I cling? Why should I crave when it hurts to do so? But to see that takes a quiet mind, to really be still and quiet, but not just still and quiet, but to have some sense of being, of well-being. And one of the functions of sitting in meditation is over time, it takes a while, to come to a settled, still, stable place where there's a kind of, the mind is not agitated and thinking a lot, and there's a kind of sense of well-being, so that we can clearly see the difference between the suffering of a movement of craving, however subtle, and the well-being. The losing of the well-being and the returning to it. Losing of it as we get caught up in the craving, those thoughts of craving, and the coming back into the well-being when we let go of it. Then we have something nice to come back to. This is so good. Why would I crave? So as practice goes along over hours, days, months, and years, there can be this wonderful point that comes where we feel like, I know something better than craving. You know, why would anybody crave? Why would I do that? Why would I pick that up? Why would I pick up hot coal when something else is better here? So they're very seeing that craving itself is suffering. So I'd like to end with a little suggestion, practice suggestion. And perhaps this idea of the Four Noble Truths can support this a little bit. See how I do here. So I think it's a little bit following up Oren's idea of, I don't remember exactly what words you used, Oren, but the idea of rather than judging negatively that you're lost in thought, celebrate that you woke up. Is that close enough? That was a wonderful idea. So to kind of follow that, this idea that you know, you don't have to do this practice that well. Appreciate it for the moments when it's working. A moment of being mindful, a moment of being present, a moment of not being caught. That feels good. That's good. Start to be content and appreciate those moments. I've done, you know, this because the mind is, I guess the mind is confused maybe or doesn't know better, but you know, I've been drifting off in thought and lost my machinations and my mind. And then I've kind of woken up, and then I'm present, I'm mindful. But I have important things to think about, you know, I just blew it. I just was a bad meditator. I was lost in my thoughts. I'm not working right. I keep drifting off. I mean, what a shame. And then, I mean, I woke up. I, you know, I was in the practice for a split moment, but I got, you know, I spent my time criticizing how I'd done it. It's actually more interesting to just think of the practice as being a success in the moment's success. So maybe you can be mindful of your breath, part of your breath, for part of a moment. Enjoy it while you have it. Appreciate it while you have it. And then mind might drift off. At some point you come back. And then appreciate that. And I think it's easier for the mind to develop continuity, to get into the process of practice, get more focused and concentrated, if there's more appreciation for the little moments than there are discouragements at the other part. The discouragement is suffering. Discouragement means that there's some kind of attachment, some kind of idea, expectation that we're measuring ourselves against. What are we attached to? What are we clinging to? Is it some idea of being the good meditator, or some idea of being successful? Or, you know, what's that? Something I have to prove. We're attached to attainment. This is all the kind of material for the Four Noble Truths. There's suffering and the judgments. What's the attachment? Can we let go of it? The world of appreciation is easier, I suggest, to do that and get into that without having any attachment and clinging. And then as we get into it, then we kind of settle in. The other thing about this teaching is that I think that the practice of breath meditation, focusing on the breath, works best if you don't try to be present 100% of the time, but 60 to 70% of the time is plenty good enough, or 50% of the time. Because one of the things that we're doing here with this practice is a massaging the mind, massaging how the mind holds on and is tight. And there's something about the mind wandering off and bringing it gently back, just trying to stay present for a little bit, appreciating those moments. The mind drifts off, come back. And that movement of back and forth can be a massage, can be a softening, a relaxing that goes into it. Provided we don't jerk the mind back, provided we don't, you know, feel angry with ourselves because we wandered off. And those are all conditions for getting tight. But if you think about, 60% is good enough that I'm present, and wandering off is part of the process, it's an important part of the process, and your contribution to that process, as soon as you notice, come back to the breathing. And together, you and your mind are doing a massage. Your mind takes you away and you come back. And those moments that you're back, just, you know, even a moment is worth appreciating. There it is, wow, this is it. And I think of it a little bit like pushing a scooter. You know, you stand with one foot in the scooter, and then the other foot you push and you glide along the sidewalk for a while, and then you lose your momentum after a while, and then you push again. So it's a little bit like that, you know, with the practice. We come back, and every time you show up and be present again, you're kind of like back, and you try to stay as best you can for as long as you can, but your momentum is going to go out at some point. Then you do it again. But different than the scooter, over time, the bearings get smoother and smoother and smoother, and you can go further and further, and after a while you stay in the present moment longer and longer and longer. But you know, come back and come back. So that was meant to be kind of an overview of the Four Noble Truths, and these next days we'll go into each of the individual Four Noble Truths. So cause is a wonderful study. If you study suffering, the conditions of suffering is a wonderful study. And to just appreciate that craving and clinging attachment in and of itself is a suffering. It's a wonderful study. And enjoying yourself in the present moment. Enjoying that wonderful feeling of saying, welcome. Open up the heart and the mind. Okay, welcome. Now we're here together, and we're going to get to know each other better. And hopefully, as you do this over the days here, you understand yourself in more and more deeper ways and fuller ways, and you find your way to have greater ease, greater peace, greater wisdom in this life. And it's a beautiful process. So I hope that you enjoy it and that it's significant for you. And I think all three of us teachers are looking forward to our meetings with you starting tomorrow. Thank you.